and welcome aboard the Battleship Pretension. I'm David Bax, and that's it. It's just me. This is a solo episode, but what more do you need? It's just going to be me talking about the... Well, we'll get to the topic in just a second. I suppose we should just start with the TweakedAudio.com ad. So let me tell you about TweakedAudio.com. TweakedAudio.com is where you go for professional quality earbuds in a variety of stylish styles and colorful colors that look great. They sound great. I use them each every day. Today I was using them. Well, I was using them to listen to a work Zoom meeting, but also I was listening to you know me. What do you think I was listening to? Obviously, I've been listening to the new Olivia Rodrigo album. On repeat, nonstop. It's really good. I like it more the more I listen to it. I think, and I loved Sour, but I think it's an expansion. I mean, both in terms of like the subject matter. They're not entirely songs about exes, though there are definitely songs about exes, and they're good. There are songs about other things too, but also sonically. I mean, I think like she's. She and whoever else is, I didn't look up the credits to see who produced the album with her, but they're trying fun new things in the studio. The first single, Vampire, I still haven't gotten sick of it. It still builds as it goes and is so exciting. I'm just really into this album. And it sounded great on my TweakedAudio.com earbuds. They're available at a low, low price at TweakedAudio.com. But if you use the offer code PRETENTION at checkout, you get 1/3 off that low, low price and no shipping charges. So please go to TweakedAudio.com and use the offer code PRETENTION.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Okay, let me tell you. Let me tell you. That's how I start the ad. That's not what I'm doing here. Let's get into it, shall we? It is time for the TIFF 2023 wrap up. I'm sorry. I'm trying to look at my notes. Normally, I have someone to bounce off of while I do that kind of bullshit. And so I'm just going to go through the movies that I saw and tell you about them. That's what a wrap-up is. This is what I did last year. I did it solo. I think I did it solo for Sundance this year. I now can't remember, but it's become kind of a preferred way. Even before Tyler got sick, when I started doing the occasional movie journals by myself, I started to feel more comfortable doing it. Let me know if I'm annoying. I mean, I know I'm annoying, but you know what I mean. Let's start with, so I got to Toronto last year when I went to TIFF. When I landed, I don't know what was happening, what the problem was, but it took me 2 hours to get out of the airport because you have to go through customs at the Toronto airport when you get there. And so this time I was like really nervous it was going to happen again, and I was going to have to switch up my plans and not make it. But I ended up making plenty of time. I breezed through customs because I'm not a suspicious person, and made it to my Airbnb, and then picked up my badge, and even had time to grab a quick bite, and then sat down for my first screening of TIFF, first of 15 films we'll be talking about, the new film from Ryusuke Hamaguchi, who made Drive My Car and Wheel of Fortune of Fantasy in 2021. His new movie is called Evil Does Not Exist, and it takes place in a small town, a small Japanese town where some developers are looking to build a glamping business in the like in the rural part. They're going to build fancy campsites to attract moneyed city folks for you know, looking for fun vacations. They end up, there's a guy in the town who's he's a single father and or I think a widower, and he's kind of like the I think he refers to himself as the odd job man. He's just the guy that, like, he's just a handyman that does different things for different people. And so the potential developers, or the people who are the front, you know, the outreach for the developers, sort of enlist him to, like, show them around the town and tell them what can and can't be done. There's a lot of objection in this town to this sort of thing happening. And I think the movie is intentionally, or the character, the odd job man, is cagey, I think, about where he stands on it. And that's, I think, part of the one of the multiple, the movie's great, and there's a lot of threads of things going on, and one of them, because multiple characters go through this, of like being unsure, being wishy-washy, and then like suddenly making a stern, like, hard decision on something. So that seems to be one of the threads, but it also feels like Hamaguchi is also like saying something or exploring the idea of being dependent on the land, because we have this idea of like living off the land, and that's what a lot of the people in this small town do. There's a woman who runs a noodle shop who moved from the city out there so that she could make noodles with the local spring water, and so there's a lot of relationship to the land. There are long takes of people chopping wood that are like absolutely fascinating. But from the other point of view, these developers would also be like taking advantage of this public land, or buying this land, and like, so what is it to live off the land or exploit the land? Is there somewhere in between? That seems to be a lot of the dialectic, I think, of the movie. It's the other thing, the idea of like someone might be closer to a strong position on something than they seem, and you never can be quite sure where you stand because you can never know another person. That's kind of what really stuck out to me. And that was my first movie of the fest. It was I should say right off the bat, it was just like, it was a good festival. Like, I did not see anything that I didn't like at least a little bit. I loved a lot of the stuff I saw. That was first. That same night, I went to another press and industry screening and ran into a friend of the show, Mariah E. Gates, and she and I watched Molly Manning Walker's How to Have Sex, which, I mean, thank God. Like, I've been wondering if someone could show me the ropes on that for a long time. Now, this is a movie about three English girls who have just, my understanding is, I think they've just graduated high school or whatever you would call that, and they're going on like a week-long, it's like a spring break, it's like an organized thing where they buy passes and they're staying at this hotel and there's like organized parties and events, but it's like a spring break type thing. I'm sure like UK listeners are probably like annoyed with me right now because there probably is a name for this sort of thing. I just don't know. But anyway, it's three girls on a spring break, for American viewers and listeners, a spring break type experience. That's all you need to know. And it's really quite good. Molly Manning Walker and her cast, especially her lead, Mia McKenna Bruce, just build this natural relationship between the girls, among the girls, and also a fantastic sense of the heightened atmosphere of this kind of party week thing, that like everything is loud and people are close and it's fun, but it's also like there's pressure at the same time to have fun, and like like, not that this is a movie, this movie isn't like Lost in Translation at all, but Lost in Translation is also a movie that gets how like when you're on a vacation or you're out of town, everything can feel a bit like heightened and like condensed into like a shorter time. And I think this movie really gets at that. It's very, there's some thrilling party sequences, there's some very funny stuff, but I should also warn you, it ends up getting into some rough stuff too. The main sort of, if there's a story, or I mean, obviously there's a story, if there's a plot, which there isn't really, but if there's a plot, it's that like Mia McKenna Bruce's character, whose name is Tara, I can't do these accents, Tara, is the only virgin among the group, and her other two friends want her to lose her virginity on this trip, and you know, that doesn't all, you know, that I don't want to get too spoilery, but there's some rough stuff in the movie, but the focal point here and the center of the movie is Mia McKenna Bruce as Tara. She's fantastic. I also love, this is not a thing that Americans do in terms of nicknames, but her name's Tara, but her friends call her Taz, and I love it. I love every time they call her Taz. So yeah, that's that. So then here's the thing about being 40 now. This is my first TIFF since I'm 40. Jet lag. I mean, like, I always had it when I would go to TIFF, but the idea that, like, I'm 3 hours behind and I'm having to get up early to go sit in dark rooms, like, I end up so tired at TIFF. And it isn't until, like, I'm on there 5 days. It's, like, on the last day that I'm like, okay, I think I've adjusted and I'm going back to California time. But, so yeah, I had flown in, watched these two movies, went back to my Airbnb, and then got up for an 8:50 a.m., meaning 5:50 a.m. in my West Coast head, screening of a 3-hour, movie called The Delinquents, which is a, Argentinian, I guess comedy. It's dry, and bemusing. It definitely has funny stuff in it. But it also has, it's been some time to ponder things as well. It pulls a nice, like, little switch on sort of who the main character is. 'Cause we watch this guy who's like a manager at a bank. And we follow him for the first part of the movie, and he apparently sort of on an impulse, because he suddenly has an opportunity to do it, he steals like I think $650,000 from the bank and leaves with it, and then he reveals his plan, which is he basically blackmails another. So suddenly this other guy who's a teller at the bank that was like more or less in the background for most of the movie up until this point, suddenly he like blackmails him into holding onto the money, and his thing is like, I'm gonna go turn myself in, I'm gonna do a 3.5-year prison sentence, and then when I get out we'll split the money, and if you don't do it I'm gonna tell them that you helped me. Suddenly like that guy goes off and basically, yeah, gets himself arrested, and suddenly, like, the teller is our main character, and there's a lot of comedy around the sort of awkwardness and paranoia that he, the pressure and paranoia that, that, that he feels. But the movie ends up having this very amusing motif, I think, of two different people finding themselves in similar situations or making similar choices, because eventually we do, I guess this is a minor spoiler, but eventually we do jump back and see what the guy who stole the money did between blackmailing the guy and turning himself in. And we see like similar thing come up in these two men's lives. And there's other like little sort of jokes about it. There's the, character who plays the boss at the bank, or the actor who plays the boss at the bank, also plays the head of the gang in the prison. And that's just like, there's no reason to have the same actor except for it to be a funny situation where like this guy has found himself under the thumb of the, he's in an attempt to completely like revitalize his life, he's found himself under the thumb of essentially the same guy. And so that idea of like people continuing to find themselves going with the same flows, and I guess it inspires questions about like how much is personal like individual choice, and how much is just like, yeah, going with the with the flow of the world, and choosing the path of least resistance leads people to the same state, the same situations over and over again. There's also jokes about like multiple characters in the movie have names like Roman and Moran, and then Norma and Morna. Like there's all these similar names, and I can't remember now if it's Norma or Morna, but the actress's name is Margarita Molfino, and she plays a woman who lives in the out in the countryside when our bank teller like goes to try and like, you know, take the pressure off and goes out to the countryside. He has a little fling with this woman, and Margarita Molfino is incredible in the role. But I can't remember if she's Morna or Norma. Next up is, oh, this was maybe my second most anticipated movie of the festival. And this is what keeps happening this festival this year, is that the movies I was looking forward to, because I was really looking forward to the Delinquents too. It had already played other festivals. I saw a lot of stuff that had played other festivals because I had read reviews, and that's what I wanted to see. And I kept having these things live up to their expectations, which doesn't always happen. So, maybe my second most anticipated movie of the festival was Radu Jude's Do Not Expect Too Much from the End of the World. And, once again, he's made an incredible movie. I can tell you what the movie is about. It doesn't really matter. The story, I guess, is just there's a young woman who works as a production assistant for a production company in Bucharest, the movie, except for a prologue at the end, just follows her over the course of one very long work day where she's just like running errands and meeting people and picking things up and dropping things off and doing the kind of stuff that PAs do over the course of like the 16, 18 hour day. It's just it's a long movie too. It's 2 hours and 45 minutes or whatever. The movie is also peppered with a couple of things. One, the main character has a like a TikTok persona where she pretends to be like, does a satire of like an Andrew Tate type guy, and so we see all of these bits of her as that character. And then also there's an actual Romanian movie oh damn it, I wrote down part of it. It's Angela something. Angela, I can't remember, from like the 70s, that is a movie about a female cab driver. And the movie keeps cutting in clips of that movie, and sometimes we'll see like the same neighborhood, you know, obviously 50 years apart or whatever, 40-50 years apart. So the movie's very funny, as is generally true of Ryder Uday's movies. More importantly, I think that it feels high-minded and overreaching. It might feel like that to compare Ryder Uday to Jean-Luc Godard, but he really does fit a lot of the way that he is. Not only he's having conversation with film history by film history and sociopolitics by including the clips of this old movie, but he's also embracing new visual languages in the same way that, you know, Godard would eventually do 3D and stuff like that. The fact that we see like shots that are TikTok filters, and there's a Zoom interview where there's the guy changes his background and is moving the phone while he's talking, so he seems to be like bouncing around in the night sky or whatever. These things that have are so, especially post-pandemic and rise of social media, these ways of seeing the world are actually very common in our lives, but weirdly not in movies. It's movies have I think been reticent to adopt the language of new visual entertainments and communications, and the way that he is folding them into his view of the present day is really impressive. And also, yeah, he's definitely making a lot of, I mean, he's not like lecturing, but he's definitely got a clear point of view. So he's got that didacticism, I think, that people rightly would associate with Godard. So it's turned out to not be my favorite movie of the festival, but at the time that I saw it, it definitely was. Next up is a movie. A Western called The Dead Don't Hurt, which I saw at the, not to get too, I am going to get too, like granular about the experience of TIFF. They retired the Winter Garden and the Elgin and the Ryerson. I've never been in the Roy Thompson Hall, which is where the huge premieres take place, because like I'm not even bothering trying to get tickets to that. And then they added last year and this year the Royal Alexandra, but the other like big theater that they use, that I've seen many movies at over the years, is called the Princess of Wales Theater. It's a beautiful theater, but I had noticed that like I had never seen anything great there before. I'd seen good movies and I'd seen bad movies. I saw The Good Nurse there. It was a very bad movie. But I'd seen good movies. I saw Chevalier last year. I saw The Personal History of David Copperfield back in, I guess, 2019. I saw that there. I saw the Gloria Bell, Lelio's remake of his own movie Gloria, but I'd never seen anything great, and that will change over the course of the 2023 festival, but not right now. So I saw a Western directed by and starring Viggo Mortensen and also co-starring Vicky Creeps called The Dead Don't Hurt. It's well made. It's it definitely follows a lot of the Western sort of tropes of like, hey, I'm a guy just trying to live my life with my wife on the outside of town, or, you know, my own little hidden cabin, but there's a rich baron who's making things difficult for me and the other people in town, and eventually someone's gonna have to do something about it and all that stuff. Like, that's all things that happen here. Luckily, but you've got, I mentioned Viggo Mortensen and Vicky Creeps, obviously the stars, but you've also got Danny Houston as the mayor. You've got W. Earl Brown playing another bartender, and Garrett Dillahunt is, you know, the rich evil guy. and then his son is played by an actor named Solly McLeod, who, like, it wasn't until the end. I spent the whole movie thinking it was Jack Rayner with a mustache. I don't know. It looks a lot like Jack Rayner. Anyway, yeah, it's definitely pretty to look at and well acted. It's got a non-linear structure that I don't really have a problem with. Like, maybe I got confused a couple times. That could be just me being stupid. But yeah, it was fine. But then I saw another movie that I was getting good reviews. I was looking forward to it, and it more than lived up to my expectations. Wim Wenders' Perfect Days. Man, it's so great. And it's just so up my alley too. It's about a guy who's a single middle-aged man, if maybe closer to elderly than middle-aged, lives alone in a small apartment in Tokyo, and his job, he gets up early and he goes around cleaning the public toilets, which, yeah, let's pause and say, like, I was so jealous of Japan and Tokyo that they just have, like, free public toilets all over the city, free public bathrooms, yeah, we don't get that here, because we don't take care of, we abandon people who have fallen out of the bottom of the capitalist system, and they have no other place to go. So our solution, instead of helping these people, is to just, like, give them fewer places to be indoors and out of the elements. Cruel. America is a cruel society, and it makes me mad sometimes. All right. So back to the movie Perfect Days. So yeah, his job is that he drives around all day, and he has his own van. He has a tape player, and he has a bunch of tapes, like mostly 70s and 80s rock. So or like, I don't know, underground rock. There's a lot of Lou Reed in Velvet Underground. There's some Patti Smith. I'm trying to remember what else we hear. I know there's Otis Redding. Yeah. The Animals, yeah. So yeah, he listens to, yeah, 60s stuff as well. So he just drives around from job to job, from toilet to toilet, or I get whatever, cleaning them and then listening to music. And then some storylines emerge where he has a younger coworker that sometimes he meets up with and they, on the larger bathrooms, they share the work, and that coworker has a girlfriend who gets involved, and then there's another person later that I want to give things away, but it's still mostly, when we did our fall movie preview, Scott said that based on reading reviews of it, it sounded like it was the Japanese Patterson, and it really does have a lot of those same that same cadence and those same beats of a guy just sort of like having a simple government job and enjoying it and enjoying his simple life. There is some more there's some more character stuff that gets unfurled by the end, but that tone and that pacing is really what drew me in and what kept going. It's just another great, beautiful movie. And yeah, I really want to go to Tokyo. Okay, so the next morning I saw a new Michael Winterbottom film called Shoshana, and as I had said on the TIFF preview 2 weeks ago, when I mentioned this movie, like, Michael Winterbottom is still a name that I, you know, that pricks my ears up, but I also have not liked the last couple movies of his that I saw. So, so I was a little bit trepidatious, but Shoshana is a real solid, like, you know, if you think of Winterbottom as his sort of like sturdy old fashioned journeyman type of director, like, Shoshana definitely, it works. I am definitely not well versed enough in the politics of 1930s Palestine and how they relate to the politics of Israel and Palestine today to know how this movie will be received by people who do know more about that type of stuff. I am very curious to see. But the movie, the Shoshana of the title, so it's Palestine before the founding of Israel, but there's already a lot of Jews living there, and more by the day because of people fleeing Hitler's Germany. And the Shoshana of the title is sort of daughter of a wealthy Jewish family who has lived in Palestine for years already. And then Douglas Booth, I don't really know. I felt like I recognized him, but I couldn't place it, and I'm kind of looking at it now and being like, I don't know if I did recognize this guy. Douglas Booth plays a British sort of law enforcement. It's unclear, like, they call him a policeman, but I think he works for the military, but it's British control. Palestine is under British control, and his job is to, he's one of the people tasked with keeping the peace. And I think this is where the politics get in that I don't know, like, if I don't know how much the British law enforcement or military of the time I don't know if they were favoring the Jews over the Arabs there, which is kind of what the movie shows, but then also there's Harry Melling's character who sees treats them both equally, which means not in a good way. He treats them with equal disdain and lack of compassion. So yeah, I'm very curious when this movie comes out to read some, like, think pieces and explainers, and read probably a lot of anger about certain things that I didn't understand. But just as a political thriller and a romance, it just hits. It's a solid movie, surprisingly bloody. I mean, I guess it shouldn't be surprising, but for a movie of it that seemed to be like sort of middle brow, genteel, and pedigreed, there's way more, like, you know, detached body parts in the movie than I would have, maybe not way more, but a few more detached body parts than I would have imagined. So yeah, that's Shoshana. Man, talking by myself takes a lot out of me. Sorry to keep having to pause. All right. The next movie I saw, back at the Princess of Wales, and here's where we broke the curse. I saw Azazel Jacobs, His Three Daughters. That's another, hold on, another aside. One of the fun things about going to festivals with the directors are there is learning how to pronounce their names, because they get introduced and they're there and it's Azazel. Not that I knew how to say it before, but that's what it is, Azazel Jacobs. Also, I mentioned that, so the director was there, none of the cast was there, obviously, because of the SAG thing, but a lot of these independent movies had waivers, so there were some actors there, so, like, Viggo Mortensen, obviously, and Vicky Creeps were at the screening of The Dead Don't Hurt, and they were clear to say that they, like, had a waiver, I also loved Viggo Mortensen introducing his very multinational, like, cast and crew and pronouncing everyone's names just, like, with perfectly. But anyway, so back to His Three Daughters. And it's too bad the cast wasn't there, because what a cast it is. Carrie Coon, Elizabeth Olsen, and Natasha Lyonne play sisters. And, yeah, I know what you're thinking. Those three play sisters? And it is, yeah, it's weird, but it also is pretty quickly revealed that Natasha Lyonne is not a blood relation. They are all sisters, but doesn't have any. So at least you're only dealing with, okay, do Carrie Coon and Elizabeth Olsen look like they could be sisters? But they've all reconvened in the New York apartment where they grew up and where their father still lives and where Natasha Lyonne's character still lives, because he is very sick and clearly their plan is to stay there until he dies, however long that takes. And it's the movie is, if you saw Azazel Jacobs' last movie, French Exit, which I did and loved, despite having this sort of, like, sounds like a straightforward kind of drama structure or premise or whatever, it does have some idiosyncrasies in the way that the dialogue is written and the way that he shoots people delivering dialogue. The movie just starts with Carrie Coon against a completely blank wall just going off about something, and then we see it's a straight-on shot, and we see a straight-on shot of Elizabeth Olsen and a straight-on shot of Natasha Lyonne, and it's, and, like, it goes on for a while until he finally reveals the sort of, like, the establishing shot that we would expect to be at the beginning, where we finally understand the spatial relationships of these characters to one another, which, if a student film did that, it would seem like a mistake, but it's very clearly his intention to start with you not understanding their physical relationship to one another, as you, and then understand that as you come to understand their, or start to understand their actual relationships with one another. I was going to say something else about the movie, and comparing it to His Three Daughters. Comparing it to French Exit. But yeah, it does have its idiosyncrasies. It's very funny, even though it's obviously about, you know, the death of a loved one, and about all the sort of wounds that exist among this this family. But it ends up becoming something just so beautiful, and so, like, there's some of the best films, or some of the best works of art, I think, are works that come right up against the borderline of being, like, embarrassing, because they're, like, being too, the artist has, like, put themselves into it so much that they're very exposed and vulnerable, and sometimes these things even are embarrassing and are so great. And I think His Three Daughters, the way that it builds toward a climax and a catharsis that I think in the wrong hands, and probably in most artists and most storytellers' hands, would come across as trite and obvious and platitudinal. But there's it's so beautifully executed and so beautifully acted by these three women. Oh, also, is it Giovanna Depo from Babylon has a small role. He might qualify for the Bruce McGill Award, actually, if when we do the BPs. But the way that it's handled by Azazel Jacobs and the cast ends up being so beautiful as to be, I don't know, elevating. I just absolutely loved the movie, and that was, I mean, I had also loved French Exit in a different way. It's a different kind of movie than this in many ways, and so I was hoping I would like this, but I really was surprised by how much I liked it. Next up, I saw a movie directed by Sarah Suma, called Arthur and Diana. That is, it's in German and French, and I think a little Italian too, because it's a European road trip movie. Two siblings, grown siblings, and one of them has a daughter, are driving to see family, or there's a whole thing we don't need to get into, but the movie is mostly a just a road trip movie, and it's very, you know, very episodic. It's also, in a way that's really great, it's very low budget and very lo-fi looking. I don't know what they shot it on, but it reminded me of those sort of like late 90s, early 2000s, like movies that were shot on like mini DV cams and stuff like that. It had that look, and among the best types of movies among those from that time, it also had that sense of freedom and innovation. Sorry. It has that sense. There are so many parts at every sort of stop on the course of the road trip. Sarah Suma seems to be inspired to put the camera in a place that we hadn't thought of before, and so there are like these super close up, like straight on shots, or there are these super low angle or high angle shots. But it never feels like that sort of like first time director thing of trying to prove, I don't know if she is a first time director, but I'm just saying that's something that first time directors I think do is try to like prove they have a visual point of view, by making really sort of self-conscious, choices. But, this felt just like fun and free and inspired. No, it's not her first feature. She's made she made one called The Last to See Them, which is an Italian horror drama. That sounds cool. She made a couple of shorts. Anyway, now I've distracted myself, as I tend to do. I don't remember what else, but very fun movie. And funny movie as well. I guess I should have said that Arthur and Diana were played by Diana is Sarah Suma, and Arthur is played by her real life brother, and I think the kid is actually her son, as well. So it's, they're playing siblings, but they also are siblings, and that's fun. Okay. What's next? What are you up to? What do we got, going on Now, okay. Oh, yeah. I'm a big fan of the director Kleiberman Dontofilo. I loved Aquarius. I saw Bacurau. I saw that at TIFF in 2019, right? If I'm doing the... remember correctly. And so he had a documentary at TIFF, the only documentary that I saw. It's called Pictures of Ghosts, and it is a documentary about sort of the places that Philo called home when he was young, meaning his mother's apartment, which we see has gone over multiple renovations and has actually appeared in some of his movies. We see clips from like Neighboring Sounds, like, and we also see like the film clips from films he made, you know, little videos he made as a kid in the apartment with his friends and family and stuff. And so that's fun to see the actual apartment and see how it's shown up in the movies. But then also the sort of second half of the movie is devoted to like the movie theaters that he went to as a kid, most of which are closed now. And so I guess documentary is, you know, what the like generic category you would put this in, but I guess it's more of like a personal sort of essay or a diary, maybe a diary, it's or a memoir, I guess. He narrates it. He does eventually appear in the movie as well. It's a very it's fun at times, but it's also obviously very bittersweet because it's, you know, about the past and things that aren't there anymore. And he manages, you know, to make it visually interesting as well. There's so much, you know, so much footage that he has of, like, a lot of stuff that he shot, but also older footage and stuff like that. It's he's got like Janet Leigh at the in his city when he was a kid, and there's some newsreel footage of that. I really, really enjoyed it. Pictures of Ghosts. Okay, so next up is a movie called Mambar Pierrette. It takes place in Cameroon, and it's about a woman named Mambar Pierrette, I guess, who is a seamstress, and she, you know, makes clothes and dresses for her neighbors and their kids, and, you know, takes orders, and it's a very sort of like cash business, you know, haggling over prices and stuff like that. It's a very, like, she's a woman of the neighborhood, and she has children of her own and a sick mother, a series of things happen to her over the course of the movie. That sounds like so generic, but it's almost like it feels almost like correct to describe it that way, because what's so fascinating about the movie to me is that every shot, every scene is just fully in the moment. Like, you never feel like the movie is setting the stage for what's going to come, even though it is, you know. But there's something, it's just very beautiful. And it's directed by Rosina Mfetgo Mbakam. I don't know if I'm saying all of those things correctly, but this is her first narrative, like, fictional film. She's made documentaries in the past that I've really liked, so that's why this was on my list, and I'm so glad that I saw it. It's It's just a really beautiful movie, Mimbar Pierrette. All right. Next up, Fallen Leaves is the new film by Aki Kaurismäki. And, I mean, if you know his work, you know what you're in for. And there's that sounds like I'm criticizing, but, man, it's just great. I guess the movie is about it's a sort of romance I guess about a man and woman who they start a relationship kind of, but it seems like the only thing they have in common is that they're loners, which is maybe not the best way to build a relationship with someone, but we both love being alone. Let's hang out together. But so that's what the story is. But I feel like with Aki Kaurismäki, that's not really what I'm looking for. I'm looking for these beautiful setups and frames and meticulously lit like a stage, but it's also real at the same time. And there's also a lot of comedy. It's the movie is very funny in that dry Aki Kaurismäki way. And so it feels like on the one hand you know what you're in for, on the other hand, who's going to complain about that when you're in for something so good? All right. Oh, we're at the home stretch here. Next movie is Seven Veils, the new movie from friend of the podcast, Adam Egoyan. It stars the great Amanda Seyfried, who I've become such a fan of more and more. I mean, obviously, I was a fan of Mean Girls, and I was a fan of Big Love, but as she's, become, I mean, I don't know how old she is. She's still younger than I am, but, as she gets more mature and closer to, middle age or whatever you want to say, she keeps getting better to me as an actor, and I'm, and Seven Veils is a terrific performance and definitely asks a lot of her, because if you know Adam Egoyan's movies, there's, a lot of psychosexual Sturm und Drang. Again, that sounds like I'm criticizing, but I love it. I love it so much. There are multiple layers. There are flashbacks. There's a lot of stuff going on. Amanda Seyfried plays a theater director who has been hired. It's very much a Toronto movie. Has been hired by the Toronto Opera, I guess, to remount a production that the opera did years earlier of Salome, and it was the director of the original was her mentor, and he picked her before he died. It was like his dying wish that she would helm this restaging, but obviously there come to be a lot of other layers we uncover about their mentorship or their friendship or their relationship or whatever it was. And all of this comes out in the way that Amanda Seyfried's character, named Janine, comes closer and closer to either some sort of major breakthrough or some sort of major breakdown. As she is remounting this production and putting more and more of herself into it, she's getting pushback from all sides, and it's very much Adam Egoyan in his lane, if you like that, which I do, there's no reason you won't like it. I remember thinking
as I was watching it, I was like, I think we've talked about this on the podcast before, like sometimes when you're liking a movie and you like find yourself already imagining what people aren't going to like about it and getting mad at that, I was like, oh, people are going to think this is like overheated, you know, that this is going too big, and I was like already mad about that, but the reviews have been good, so I guess I was wrong to underestimate people. Also, weirdly, one of the cast members, like within in the Salome production, is played by Douglas Smith, who played Amanda Seyfried's brother on Big Love. So that was a weird, that was a fun, like, fun little, I don't know. I'm also like, right now I'm kind of like bracing myself because I, have to, talk about this next movie, which is a fantastic movie, but it's going to be difficult to try and talk about. So the next movie that I saw, the penultimate movie of my festival and the movie that I was most looking forward to, is Jonathan Glazer's The Zone of Interest. So I saw the, I saw The Zone of Interest, and I cannot overstate how amazing an achievement this movie is, and how, you know, when I left, I was so glad that I saw it, that I didn't see it with anybody I knew, so that I could just like walk afterwards, ride the subway back to my Airbnb. I went and sat at a bar, and just like, I was recovering from how powerful the movie ends up being by the end, but also like thinking back on the movie and continue being like, oh my God, like, I mean, it's, this is stupid to say, but it's like, oh, he knew where the movie was going. Of course he did. Jonathan Glazer directed the whole movie, but like the way that he like lays, like plants the seeds for the movie to come to the place where it does. That I mean, it's based on a novel, The Zone of Interest. It's, in case you don't know, it's about an SS officer and his family. The officer is a commandant at Auschwitz, and he has, because of his high position, he has a beautiful home with, you know, his own private like greenhouse and swimming pool and all this beautiful home, but it's literally right outside of Auschwitz, like it shares a wall practically. You can see the guard tower, one of the guard towers, from their backyard. And I remember when I was in Berlin and we went and visited Sachsenhausen, which actually does get mentioned in the movie for whatever that's worth, or it comes to play a role in the movie. All the concentration camps get mentioned, but Sachsenhausen becomes a part of the movie, of Zone of Interest. Yeah, but you take the train from Berlin out to Oranienburg, which is the little like suburb that Sachsenhausen is in, and you're walking through this neighborhood of these really nice homes that people continue to live in to this day, and then you turn a corner and there's a concentration camp just right up against these homes. And I guess I remember our tour guide at Sachsenhausen saying that like at the time those would have been like the homes of the SS officers and the hiring people who worked at the camp. And so that's what Zone of Interest is. It's sort of like, conceit is that we never see the inside of the camp. It all takes place with this family. Yeah, for the most part, it all takes place with the family, and it's hard for me to describe I'm trying to figure out how to lay out the things that I loved about it without talking about the final sort of like 5-10 minutes of the movie, which it made me sick to my stomach, but also like it felt cathartic, and it was just anyway. I think the conceit of the movie being like not seeing the concentration camp is that we already know A, what horrors went on in there, and B, we already know that the Nazis get defeated. And so as we're watching this family sort of live, I mean, we open with them playing at the river, you know, taking a day on a weekend to go have a family like sort of picnic and swim in the river. This idyllic lifestyle, but also the way that they fight to keep it. Sandra Hüller from Tony Erdmann plays the wife, and the officer is played by the guy from a movie called 13 Minutes, which is also Nazi related, but I'm drawing a blank on the fella's name. Christian Friedel. They're great, and the way that they fight, like with each other, with their families, with the SS sort of bureaucracy, to maintain this home and this lifestyle. Also the way they clearly take pride in it, and sort of like having other officers and their families over, but also like the way they treat their staff, their servants, is there's a desperation, I think, but the movie walks a line of like, we're not like, you're not gonna feel bad for these people because of how they got, they have cast their lot. This is the reward. They're fighting so hard to keep it, even though we know that there is an expiration date on this and on them, and that and the ability of Glazer to not make the movie just, you know, 2 hours of reveling in, you know, the Schadenfreude or whatever of what's going to become of these people, but also not making them sympathetic. It's really quite an achievement, quite a needle threaded, and quite an impact for a movie that goes out of its way to not depict the things that have made Holocaust related movies a go-to for many people for exploring the things that people are willing to do to one another to get themselves ahead, or to convince themselves that they're right. The Zone of Interest is just it also doesn't make like the, I'm even just thinking about this now, like the way that Jonathan Glazer shoots the house is almost like he's shooting a museum of the house, where it's like we understand that this is a luxurious home that they live in, but it's never quite inviting or aspirational to the audience. Like it's hard to like look at this, even when you're not seeing the guard tower and hearing gunshots and all sorts of things, it's hard to imagine someone looking at this and being like, oh, I would like to live in a house like that. Again, it's just a really an amazing achievement, and definitely the best movie that I saw at TIFF. And then let's wrap up with one more. Final movie is called Sing Sing. It takes place at the prison, Sing Sing, but it also has kind of a dual title because it is a movie about a real program at Sing Sing called Rehabilitation Through the Arts, or RTA, where prisoners put on two plays a year, and they spend the time in between, you know, rehearsing and making sets and stuff like that. And Coleman Domingo plays the inmate who is also one of the founders of RTA. And Paul Racy plays the sort of volunteer. I don't know if he's a volunteer. Maybe he gets paid by the organization. But in any case, he's not an inmate. He's the one who comes in and like directs the plays and guides the rehearsals and stuff like that. But other than that, those two actors that we've heard of, pretty much every other part in the movie is played by someone who is an actual former inmate who was involved in RTA. So that sort of documentary type of approach is really the hook here. That it's not a documentary, but it is like partially about itself in a way by having these cast members play themselves a versions of themselves. That's really the draw. The main story is not, you know, it's Coleman Domingo finding inspiration, getting frustrated by his inability to get paroled, despite his innocence. I mean, the movie never actually comes out and says he's innocent, but I think that's what we're supposed to assume. It's you know, pretty standard prison story type of stuff, but it's very well acted, not just by Coleman Domingo and Paul Racy, but by all of these other actors as well. And it's shot, the director's name is Greg Quidar, and it's shot in a very sort of unassuming way, kind of not quite as lo-fi as Arthur and Diana, but it's not overly gussied up, and so that again that adds to this sort of documentary type feel, even though what we're watching is not a documentary. It's quite a good movie. I'm definitely glad I saw it, because like I said, I didn't see any bad movies at TIFF. You know, I mean, like, there's a couple that are like Dead Don't Hurt is like, it's, you know, it's fine, but it's not, I didn't see anything bad last year. I saw multiple bad movies. So this was a really successful TIFF for me. It makes me feel, especially because Sundance this year I thought was weak, and I was like, oh, this is bad. But I don't think Sundance, I don't think a good or bad Sundance is actually a predictor of a good or bad year for movies, because Sundance, the types of movies that get shown there are more like narrow, there's a narrower scope of movies, whereas TIFF is like truly international and has all kinds of movies. And so I feel like a good TIFF maybe does mean by the time we get to the end of 2023 in a few months, or later than that, when we do our actual our top 10 episode here on the podcast, I feel like this might be just a really, really strong year. I already have a top 10 that I'm pretty happy with. So that's that. You can find I'll get some reviews up of these, you can find, and you'll be able to find those at battleshipretention.com. you can email me at david@battleshipretention.com. check out my other podcast, the one where I met your mother, that's available at battleshipretention.com or wherever you find podcasts. Sign up for the patreon.com/battleshipretention, and follow me on Twitter and blue sky at davypretension. Other than that, thank you for listening, and we will catch you next time. Bye.